again. It's very tempting to just sit and look there all day. But that wouldn't really be doing anybody much good, so. I was reflecting on last night, João talked about the people who weren't here and who helped make this retreat possible. The people who are here are also helping make the retreat possible. And if we really looked, like we say in Oriokhi, 72 labors. 72 is a symbolic number to represent infinite labors. So, infinite labors make this retreat possible. And this retreat, this sangha, this community, this group, what we do here and now, is a manifestation of enlightened society. Of what an enlightened society could look like, could be. And I adopt that term enlightened society from Trungpa Rinpoche, who established his entire community and organization around with the goal of creating an enlightened society. Didn't work out that way really for his community, but it. His community is still ongoing and they're still working on it, right? So, and so what makes that enlightened society? It's because the action is selfless. It's not, so take the example of Tiago, who we mentioned, who did endless amounts of work for this retreat, and is not here. And he knew he would not be here. And he chose to invest his time and his energy, his resources, in making this retreat possible for all of us, even though he knew since last year he would not be here. And it's endless, those examples, right? And so all of us here and what we're doing here, whether we're cleaning the toilets or picking out the weeds or making the tea and the coffee or washing our own cup and keeping it apart, keeping track of that cup, this is all selfless. We're doing this, of course, we have some self-interest. We are interested in doing this probably for some, makes us feel good or we like the people or we like to do this, whatever. But underlying it is this selfless energy. Because we're not gaining anything from it. Okay, we get a clean toilet, but it's not even my toilet. I'm not even using that toilet, let's say. Taking the weeds out of the ground. I have no idea what those weeds are, where they are, why we're calling them weeds. I don't know. But it's certainly the person who's doing it is not really going to benefit personally from those weeds being taken out of the ground. If we see it from a limited personal point of view, if we're separating personal from impersonal, right? So in making the retreat possible, we're not focusing on the personal, we're focusing on the impersonal. And everything we do here is that as well. So all of the rituals are really bringing out, giving us the opportunity to experience the impersonal. We're all chanting, but we're not trying to make our voice sound better than the others. And we're not saying, oh, I don't like that word. I'm going to replace that with a different word. Or I want to chant at a different rhythm. Everyone chants the same thing. Same time, the same way, same words. That's the impersonal. And that all ritual is about that, is about cultivating the impersonal energy aspect of our being. So while I was reflecting on this, let's see, there's many different ways of infinite amount ways, grids, let's say, or systems of looking at any action, any activity, any person, any situation, war, famine. You can look at these from different possible grids or analysis systems. Recently, I read a guy who, a philosopher, psychoanalyst, who wrote a book about the what we call in French administration, l'administration, which is like bureaucracy. Okay? And looking at it, analyzing it from a psychoanalytical point of view, which is fascinating, right? It helps, it kind of eases our anxiety about the bureaucracy or standing there before the, waiting in line for something, for a piece of paper that when you get there, you might not actually get, or something. And, there was an example of, so it's a very, for an obsessional personality, bureaucracy, being a bureaucrat is ideal because you have all this detail and all this stuff you have to do, and you have control over it, and it's really intense control and all the details and everything. Whereas for someone who's obsessional, being an administ someone who's administ you know, someone who's has to be involved but is the client in the bureaucracy, they also get something out of it because they don't have to make any decisions, the obsessional. It's done for them. It's obsessional, but they don't have to do it themselves. Okay? It doesn't really matter so much. I'm just giving an example of how we can analyze something from a specific grid. And when we look at from our, Buddhist and Zen in particular point of view, when we look at the world, as you've heard me say many times, we can say the basic root of all the problems is attachment to self. So, selfless action or selfless belief or selfless self-involved concepts, let's say, self-involved action leads to suffering, pain, difficulty, trouble, anxiety, anger, greed, all of this. This is the underlying ignorance from our point of view, from experientially. This is my experience, or I wouldn't be telling you this. And throughout, since Shakyamuni Buddha, 2,500 years ago, that's the experience that is being related. The basic ignorance is believing and hanging on to this idea of self, of a fixed self that is separate from all the other, from all phenomenon, from all the other selves. From it's isolated, and the consequences of its actions are not fully realized because it's such a limited view of the situation and of because it's only related to self. This is very basic explanation of it. And as we'd say often, so if you look at it, you look at the situation and you see where self is involved with territory and possession, consuming, accumulating, aggression, greed, destruction. So any of the various problems of our world, we can look at from this grid and see it pretty clearly that it all comes from this attachment to self. And then to realize, to the wisdom to transmute that ignorant energy is to see the oneness. So when we see the oneness of things, that is, all-encompassing wisdom, because then we no longer will act from a selfless point of view because we see we're all one. And that includes the rocks and the birds and the ocean and the fish and the people who go to a different church than me, the people who have different color skin than me, who live on the other side of the border from me, my neighbors, everything, right? So this involves We see the oneness of it all, and then we behave differently. That reduces suffering and expands freedom for all, for ourselves, but also for all. So I'm giving this little capsule view of things from this Zen Buddhist point of view. And it's really quite liberating when we can experience things this way, when we see it this way. It really eases the anxiety around a lot of it. It doesn't change the fact that people are starving in Gaza. It does not change it. We see it differently, however. And then we can see how we can act in relation to that. And I'm not going to talk about starvation in Gaza and find the solutions here today, right? But that's something that we all are aware of. And I know I spent, some days recently, like seeing the headlines and not wanting to read it, not wanting to look at the pictures. No, okay, we know, but I don't want to know. And that too, when we can see it for what it is, when we can see the ground of ignorance that is giving rise to this, it's not the same anxiety to read the news article or to look at or pay attention to it. It opens the possibility to look at it in a different way. Doesn't solve it. My mini awakening around it doesn't change the fact that it's happening, but it does change the way that I experience it, and then the way that I move in the world, and the way that I then interact with others. And I will not give rise to further starvation, whether within myself or of others. And so I was thinking about Shogyam Trungpa, and he developed this, he revived an ancient teaching, which we also use in our Gate of Sweet Nectar ceremony, which we don't do very often, but we did do it last summer at our retreat, for those who were there. It's an ancient ceremony that has its roots in Shakyamuni Buddha's Sangha. And Trungpa revived these teachings around that for the Western audience, let's say, and Bernie Glassman, one of my teachers, also did. And this relates to the five Buddha families, which are just five different types of energy, they say. And Trungpa developed a whole psychology based on it, which I won't go into that. It's very elaborate. And I'm hoping to talk about this throughout the week, and maybe we can look into psychology and how we set it up too. But the reason that I am bringing this up at all is because I experienced with Bernie Glassman how he used these five Buddha family energies to structure his community and the organization of the community and how it functions. And I saw how the Zen Center of Los Angeles, which is our mother temple of our lineage in the West, uses that model to organize the community and teach, learn, practice together, and also outreach to the wider community. So I recently decided that I wanted our community to function according to this system. But in order to do that, we have to know what I'm talking about. Some other people than me have to know what I'm talking about, right? And so I decided that someone suggested when we talked about this at our General Assembly 2 weeks ago, or when was that we had it? Well, recently, yeah. And I brought the subject up, and so someone said, well, maybe you should talk about it during the summer. I said I would, and I will. I'm also planning to invite someone from the Dhamma Sangha who is a specialist in this and does a lot of workshops and teaching around these energies. I'm going to see her when I come back, and I'm hoping that she will either come to Portugal and do a workshop here. I would like her to do something online, but she can't really do a workshop online. Maybe do one in Paris when she lives in Poland, so she's not in Paris a lot either. And then that could help us to understand more what I'm talking about. So I will this week or just try to give a little indication of how I have experienced it in the workshops I did around it, in the way that I worked around it with Bernie Glassman, and how it applies to us. There are lots of books about it. The Donna Study Group, I think Debbie probably didn't, wasn't there a long study group about one of those, the five wisdoms, but it was written by a Tibetan couple or something, some
Oh,
lamas.
yeah,
I forget.
Spectrum of Ecstasy, is
Spectrum
that
of
it? Yeah.
Ecstasy, which I have not read. There's lots of books about it, but experientially is when it really makes sense. So, I'll try to ex relate some of my experiences and how Trungpa sees it, and how Bernie Glassman saw it, and how I've seen it operate. But so for Trungpa, it's really about how we relate to space, which is interesting, okay? And that our basic ignorance is around how we relate to space. We don't see that we are space, basically. And so then we divide up the space into categories and boxes and people and all of this. And I, many, 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 many years ago, when I went back to the United States after having lived in Europe for a long time, went back to the United States and was traveling from Denver to Boulder, Colorado, which is like, I don't know. Do you know how far it is? Maybe it was an hour in the car or something. Maybe a little more. I don't know. And I had never been there before. I'd never been to Denver or never been to Boulder. I was going, actually, it's funny, I was going to the Naropa University that Trungpa founded, to do a 4-week intense writing program that they organized. So I'm riding in this bus from the airport in Denver to Boulder, and suddenly I'm looking around and I have this weird experience about the space, about how different the space was than the space in Europe. Which anyone who's been to America knows, anyone who grew up in America knows, and who lives in Europe knows too as well. But I had never seen it this way before. Suddenly I saw the space, and I saw how it was like this flash where I saw that that explained the entire American experiment, the entire American way of being, character, the way Americans are in Europe, the way the American people are, the way the American, for 200 years the country has functioned, right? Because of their relationship to space. The space is vast in America, much vaster than in Europe. The way that houses are built, they aren't built like one, buildings aren't stuck together like they are in Europe, in big European cities, but even in small European villages. So like Adrien's village, all the houses are like right together and on top of each other. You don't see that in an American village at all, And because there is this abundance of space, and then the way that people relate to space is different. The way that they relate to one another is different. Things are big in America, The American presence is big, right? We were talking at lunch yesterday about the imperialism of the English language. And I am sorry that I am being an imperialist by imposing English on you. I really deeply am sorry about that. And I fully recognize that. But that's part of the American, of course, the British have done this as well, but that's part of the American relationship to space. And then how American people move. There's the proverbial American tourist in Europe who is loud and thinks everyone is supposed to serve them, and the ugly American stereotype comes from the relationships of space. Very long ago, I realized in Europe that the American people, they don't realize. They think everyone wants to be like them, So that has a relationship to do with space, because there's so much of it, or There is so much of space everywhere. Space is limitless wherever you are. But the way that we relate to it is different, right? So this is just an example of how space is really important in the way that we relate to it. And it's funny that I had this experience before I had gone to Naropa and had studied Trungpa and seen the physical spaces that they use for these different families and everything. And when you go to to Trungpa's community, there's always an empty chair on the stage because they sit on stages in the Tibetan. You know, I would be sitting up on a platform talking down to you. There's always an empty chair, and that's Trungpa's chair. So even this notion of the teacher is still there in the empty space, which is true. You know, I am sitting here. This is an empty space, but someone, if we want a living teaching to be manifest, someone has to sit here and manifest it. But it's an empty space, right? So in Trungpa's community, they continue this with this empty chair. So let's just get a basic look at these five energies, as Trungpa defines them, or families, as they're often called. They're each related to a color, they're each related to an element, and they're each related to a stage of a symbol as well, which helps us to kind of situate them. And it's taken from the mandala, a mandala of that we see very frequently in Tibetan teachings. So in the center of the mandala it's white, and that's what we call the Buddha family or the Buddha energy. Then we have the blue family, which is Vajra. We have the yellow family, which is Ratna. We have the green family, which is Karma. And we have the red family, which is Padma. Okay, these are Tibetan names. And then they each have their different bodhisattvas and things associated with them. It's all very elaborate, but we're not going to go into all that elaborate thing right now. But in the Gate of Sweet Nectar ceremony, there's a portion of the ceremony where we chant each one of these families, and we invite people to offer incense when they feel that they have some affinity with that energy. Of course, if you've never studied the energies, you have no idea if you have an affinity for it or not. However, it does say in the ceremony, you know, the Vajra family associated with knowledge or something, intellect. I don't know. So each one of them has a different symbol, color, element, a neurotic or ignorant manifestation, and a wisdom or enlightened manifestation. Each one of them has. So I will just talk about those basic things for each one today. That's probably enough. So the Buddha family, which is white, that's their color, that's the color. The element is basic space. So space. And the symbol is the wheel. So the ignorant aspect of this Buddha energy is seeing space as limited. Its basic element is basic space, right? Unlimited space. But when it doesn't see that, the neurotic manifestation is to see it limited, and it becomes selfish. It also can become sleepy, dull, blind, okay? Because it's seeing this limited space, and it's a selfish relationship to space. You know, in some respects, you know, we can see the American the American experiment is a manifestation of that, in a sense. People are big, people are overweight, you know, dull, not a lot of dynamics, you know, from the ignorant aspect. From the awakened aspect, it's the wisdom of all-encompassing space. So it sees space, endless, unlimited space, and that everything is encompassed in that. this is also the basic ignorance of all the other families. So the four families have this basic ignorance of not seeing unlimited space, but it manifests in different ways in the other families. So then we have the Ratna family, which is, the color is yellow, as I said. The symbol is jewel, something very precious. And the element is the earth, of a basic solidity, okay? So it's very earthy. And it has peace. When it's enlightened, there's peace in this basic solidity. And there's there's generosity, because the resources of the earth are unlimited. And there's a basic security in the solidity of the earth, right? The ignorant aspect, however, is grasping, of course. Resources are not limited, are limited, so I have to have more than the other. A sense of feeling, a sense of, this is interesting, a sense of feeling secure rather than being secure. And all of these four families have this, where they're, when we are not in contact with actually being it, but we're striving to become it or feel it, that's when we get into trouble. And then the ignorant aspect then is that losing connection with being secure and trying to become secure, so then need to have more resources, more things. I have to hang on to that jewel. I don't want anyone else to have that precious jewel. Pride is a big one. Feeling incomplete, needing for more, right? Fearing that I'm going to lose what I have. Whereas the wisdom of it, the enlightened manifestation, is equanimity. The wisdom of equanimity. There's no fear of loss because everything is here. And it's open and free, and we can be generous. We feel secure and generous with all the unlimited resources. We, of course, we'll get to this too. We then, in this equanimity, that means that we see the resources. We see the preciousness of them, and then we will take care of them. So, you know, maybe we can use America as an example for all of these things. You know, when we don't appreciate the resources, then we don't take care of them, right? This applies to the whole world, but just because we're staying with the American experiment. Then we have the Padma family, which the color is red. The symbol is the lotus, fire in the lotus, and the element is fire. So the Padma is associated with passion, seduction. Padma is naturally, you know, does not need to even do anything to be attractive and seductive. That's basic energy. But when it doesn't see that, then it wants to seduce everyone. And it wants everyone to like them. And it wants to, you know, hang on to people and things, and passionately grasping, right? You know, when it's not feeling, once again, when the being of unity is not seen, then there's this striving to become united. So then there's trying to get people to be one with you, you know, and then it becomes really neurotic. And it becomes, you know, this problem of what do you say in French? Fusion? You say in English? Fusion, I guess, yeah, you know, and that becomes really problematic, you know. This is not seeing that we are all one, right? When it becomes transmuted, the energy, when it becomes enlightened, then there's an appreciation, a real appreciation of unity, of oneness. And we realize we don't need to then become one with the other, because we already are. We don't need to like indulge in seduction to get people to come with us and like us, because we are already all it, you know, each person is what they are. We appreciate the individuality. And so we don't, if we don't, if we want people, if we're striving to be one with the people, we don't see them for who they truly are. We want them to be like we want them to be, or we, you know, the American way, you know. We want everybody to be American and do what we do and talk like we do and have our system of government and our traditions and eat our food and whatever. Whereas the very basic, you know, so again with America, the very basic promise of the American experience is seductive as it is. It was the land of, you know, dreams, right? And people could go and realize freedom. It's become completely perverted, but that the basic element was that, okay? When we lose track of the individuality and the differences, then that seduction becomes something else. And that beautiful, appealing, whatever it is, loses, we've lost touch with it. And we're trying to convert or seduce people or things or whatever. Meaning that that energy is self-involved rather than selfless. When we see this and that and her and him just as they are, selfless, this is what we call the wisdom of discriminating awareness. So it's, you know, if we can see that Padma, when it's ignorant, it doesn't discriminate between differences. It wants everyone to be for them, right? And attract everyone to them and involve in seductive activities. When it's selfless, it clearly sees the differences and then welcomes everyone, compassion, love, loving, warm people, for example, have a lot of Padma energy. Then, and it's red, you know, it's fire, right? The lotus. Then the karma, the color is green. And this doesn't have to do with the, you know, what we talk about, our karma, our karmic consequences. It's not that. The color is green. The symbol is the sword. And the element is the wind, which is really interesting too. The wind, you know, is naturally blowing, touches everything, goes in whichever direction is needed, or it's not like directing itself toward one thing or another. It's a very natural blowing functioning of the energy of the wind. When we have, and this applies to so us in our neurosis, when we don't see that absolutely natural functioning of energy, and this often has to do with work or organization or something like that. When we don't see that, we have to make an effort. We feel like we have to make an effort to make the wind blow, our wind. And we always need more of it, and it's never enough. And we become jealous of other people who seem to be doing it better than me. You know, their effort is better than my effort. So I have to eliminate them, or I become jealous of them, or I can even become paralyzed. I don't do anything then because it's never enough. And the others are doing it better, so I give up, right? We develop a lot of envy because we look around and ours is not enough. But when we see that our action in and of, this is related to action, our action in and of itself is enough when it's selfless, then this is what we call the wisdom of all accomplishing action. It's always enough. So in a sense, you know, our the way that we organize the retreat, if we were involved with self-involved action, we wouldn't do anything, right? We would think the other person was doing it better than me, so I'm not going to do it, or I'm going to compete with that person to wash the dishes better. Or, you know, we do have manifestations of this in retreat, you know, when someone's doing the Jikido, if they do it for the first time, suddenly everyone becomes an expert on the Jikido and is telling them how to do it, and don't do it that way, do it this way, don't, no, no, no. Whereas if we can stay with the selfless aspect of it, we can let the person discover for themselves. And the person doing it, if they're self-involved when they're ringing the bell, doesn't sound so good, right? But when they let go of their attachment of how the bell should be rung and how they want to sound and want people to see them, it just very naturally sounds perfect. This is the all-accomplishing action. My teacher's teacher, so Genpo Roshi, in his old time, you know, traditional sangha, I've told this story before, when you would be waiting in line for Doku-san, as we do, when the teacher was finished with whoever was in there, they would ring the bell, and the next person in line would go to the door. But there was a added ritual, which probably comes from Japan, I don't know, maybe Marta would know this, but when the bell rang, the next person in line would hit a drum to announce that they were coming. A drum. It was like a round drum and hit this boom so that the teacher knew that the next person was coming. And so I did this once. I was a very young practitioner and I had only seen Genpo a couple of times. It was my turn. I banged the thing. I didn't really know what I was doing. And I went in and I came in and sat down. And for some reason, oh, I think I was Genpo Roshi's Jisha. So I really shouldn't have even been in the line, but I somehow managed to work with the other Jisha and get my turn in line. And so I came in and I sat down and I kind of smiled at Genpo. You know, I said, "You didn't expect to see me, right?" He said, "Oh no, I knew it was you when you hit the drum." So this is Genpo being Genpo. But at the same time, there is something to that, you know. I didn't really know what I was doing. And I was involved with, I want to do it right. And I want to sound good. I want to be the best one, hit it just perfectly, you know. So of course it was not right. Right. You know, it was self-involved. And this is an example of all accomplishing action when it's not selfless, but selfful. Selfful. When it's selfless, it's all accomplishing. We don't need to do anything extra. Often when we do action, we're adding something extra. And we get burnout. You know? You know, high achievers also often have like a big, heavy emphasis on this karma energy. Constantly trying to achieve and do better and do more and, you know, get the best positions and write the best papers and, you know, as a journalist, you know, it would be like getting, always having the byline on page one and having the scoop and better than the others, where, and then you get like just completely, it's never enough, you know, and you don't get the position you wanted and whatever. Whereas if you just go about the task without being self-involved, it's done perfectly, you know. This takes great practice, however. We have to cultivate this practice. And the way that we do it, the way that all of these energies are transmuted from the neurotic, ignorant side to the awakened, enlightened side, is by awareness, becoming aware of the energies. We all have all components of these energies within us. We tend to have some that are more prominent than others. And then when we do workshops, so, you know, personally, I did a 5-day workshop. So each day we did, it was 5 days. So each day we focused on a different energy. You were there too. Yeah, Debbie was there too. This was a long time ago. But yeah.
Yeah, but I remember it really well. Yeah. It was very samatha.
Yeah. So each day there was a different energy that as a group we talked about, and we had exercises where we wrote down things about them and whatever. And for each day, so you were supposed to, on the Buddha day, you were supposed to dress in white. On the Vajra day, you dressed in blue. On the Ratna day, you dressed in yellow, so like that. And the activities that she organized, the one who was leading the workshop, were like on the Ratna day, Ratna activities. And on the Vajra day, Vajra activities. The food, the cooks were supposed to make the food, so as much white food as possible on the Buddha day, and as much blue food as possible on the Vajra day, or as close as you could get to it. And even the types of food, like, for example, sushi is like a really Vajra food. It's very precise. Oh, I didn't talk about Vajra yet.
No.
That's really interesting, because I have a high content of Vajra energy, which I sometimes try to mask. But I've also worked a lot on, so that's interesting that I didn't talk about the Vajra energy. It was on the next page. I was hoping you would ask, yeah, secretly. So the Vajra energy, the color is blue, the symbol is the thunderbolt, and the element is water. So the, like I said, you know, the Vajra energy is about seeing clearly and precisely, really clear and precise. And like water, it's clear. And when it's enlightened, it's, you know, like water, it's fully, relates fully with the texture of the terrain, the situation, because it sees so clearly, fully in contact with it all. However, when it is not, when it is ignorant, when it, there's a neurotic aspect, so the self-involved, the self-clinging aspect, the selfless aspect is what I described, clear, impartial, fully relating to the situation, whatever it is. The self-clinging aspect is judgmental, angry, aggressive, distances, is very distant emotionally, cold, because then it's free from any emotional involvement that would interfere with this seeing things clearly. Because if you, when it thinks that it's not seeing, when it wants to see clearly, the emotions get in the way. So it has to like cut itself off from the emotions, right? There can be no interference with seeing clearly, and people who don't see clearly are dumb. And they are judged severely because they don't see clearly. Right? A lot of frustration, anger, aggression around that, okay? So when this clear seeing of things as they are is not, when we start striving to see, then the water that is clear and peaceful and in touch with everything becomes turbulent and cloudy and, you know, huge crashing waves and rapids in the river, and turbulent and angry, right? When it's transmuted, when we see this energy clearly, then it becomes clear and luminous like the water, and the wisdom is called mirror-like wisdom. So I said, you know, sushi is a typical food that we could eat. It's very clear, precise. Japanese cuisine generally has a lot of Vajra energy in it because of that same kind of thing. And so all of these are related to aesthetics as well, you know. So, you know, Padma, like I said, is red, and so it would be like, you know, lush, flowing, red, deep colors, warm, things like that. Buddha would be white, cold, you know, empty room. Zendo is Buddha energy, but also Vajra with precise lines, things like that. And then they also have like physical, in Trungpa's version of psychology, you know, he also has like symptoms, physical symptoms that arise from an excess or a neurotic sense of the energies. So in Vajra, for example, I remember it's like headaches, nervousness, acouphen, what do we call acouphen? Tinnitus, yeah. I don't know why. I mean, it could be explored in Trungpa's thing. I'm not sure exactly, but I do remember those couple of things, those symptoms. kidney problems are associated with Vajra. I don't know why either. So when we see all this, and we can see this on a personal level, the very basic joy of our true nature, being in context of our true nature, is being experiencing the spaciousness of life, of the world, of the universe. So, and that it can be seeing the oneness of it all, that can be seeing the limitless nature of it, and it can be an appreciation for the space and the differences within that space, but that's our basic enlightened nature is that. And that's where our basic joy comes from as well. Now, how does this apply to, you know, an organization? So, in my experience with Bernie Glassman's community and with the Zen Center of Los Angeles, they set up the organization around, so, say, the Vajra energy is about study, teaching. The Padma energy is about communication, community, sangha. So that would extend to, like, the website, the emails, you know, organizing activities, talks or something, you know. Karma is, you know, making it happen, the all-accomplishing action of, you know, in a physical center, it would be taking care of the grounds and the facilities, anything to do with work and action. So it's often associated with work. Ratna is to do with the resources, so the finances. And the sometimes we put the cooks, the tenzo, in the Ratna family, because that's about feeding, taking care of those resources, taking care of the garbage, these are just really general ways of looking at it. But so, for example, in Bernie Glassman's community, he started out with just a big, huge Zen center in a mansion in a rich neighborhood in the suburbs of New York with a bunch of wealthy, educated people, white people who came and sat together and did Zen practice. The neighboring suburb was this very poor, poor community. Lots of homelessness. It was, you know, the AIDS crisis, drugs, single mothers with small children, unemployed people, you know, all the urban blight problems you can think of. And it was mostly black, but there were some white and other, you know, racial. There was a racial mix, but it was primarily black. Whereas the suburb he lived, his center was in, was, you know, super white, rich people. And he went there because someone had given him this, or made this available to him, this mansion. Or someone gave him a huge donation and it was for sale, I don't know. So he needed to find something to support his own community. So he decided looked at these five families, and he decided, well, they had a really strong study component. They were studying Zen, meditating, all of this. They had the resources because they had rich people who were contributing to it. They had Padma because they had a strong community and, you know, community and communicating with one another. But their karma was lacking, you know. They didn't have much work going on, and they weren't also, from the Padma point of view, they weren't reaching out to anyone beyond their little, they were seeing a very limited view of space. It was only their little community that they were involved with, or other Buddhist communities, or the lineage, but they weren't involved with the greater community. So he looked at these families, and he decided they needed to do some work. So they decided they would bake cakes and cookies and sell them. They would make really high-end You know, they had high-end rich people who were used to gourmet food in their community. They would make these really gourmet cakes and cookies and sell them to a, like the equivalent of, you know, this really fancy department store, Bloomingdale's in New York City. I don't know what it would be in Portugal. You must have some like fancy, what? I don't know. Anyway, a fancy shop, a store where rich people shop, and would sell them to that store, and then the store would sell them to their rich clients, the food, the bakery, the baked goods. And they were making money from this, you know? But then Bernie said, okay, well, that's not enough. I don't want you people making the food. Let's put our bakery in the poor neighborhood and let's have the poor people, let's give them jobs and help support their community while also supporting our own community. Have it, you know, this is kind of a Robin Hood story where they're taking from the rich people who are going to buy their stuff and giving it to the poor. In order to do this, he had to sell his rich, huge Zen center and tell the people, okay, the Zen practice, we will do some Zen sitting, we will do some retreats, but our practice is going to be building this bakery and selling these cakes. A lot of people left because they didn't like that. They said, no, that's not Zen, and no, we're not going to stay. So, you know, the community was fewer people, but they still managed to do it. And with this karma energy, instead of like striving to do something incredible, they just looked at the situation with, you know, the water, the clear seeing Vajra selfless energy, and saw the situation and said, okay, these people, we can hire them, we can train them to make these cakes. A lot of them are have been imprisoned for various things because that's kind of how it happens in the black community in America is, you know, they have problems with the law, not because they're black, but just it's the whole social economic situation. And they would not be hired by other employers often because they had a prison record or something. So Bernie said, we don't care. We don't care what their history is. If they want to work and they'll accept to be trained to do it, we'll take them. Okay, so they did this. Then the Vajra energy sees, well, there's a problem because these people don't have any place to live. So a lot of these people were homeless. So with this karma energy and the Ratna energy with the resources, they took some of the resources and they bought a building and they converted it into apartments. With the Padma energy, they reached out with communication to like the local government and got donations. They got grants to do this, built apartments for people so the employees could work, have an apartment, low income, work in this, and survive, basically. Well, there were single mothers who would be happy to do that, but they didn't have anyone to take care of their children, and they couldn't afford to pay for childcare. So, again, these different energies combined from a selfless, not a self-involved, neurotic point of energy, but the selfless point of energy, and created a daycare center so that the single mothers could now have a place to live, they could have a job, and they could have daycare for their children. They hired people to take care of these children, to work in the daycare center, and they trained people to work in the daycare center. They also, there was the, you know, AIDS problem at that time. This was in the late 80s. Big problem with AIDS, and so they set up a some kind of hospice or clinics thing. I forget exactly what it was that they set up to help deal with that problem in the community. And this all came from the community, the Zen community, studying these five energies. And then with, you know, Bernie saying, okay, we're not going to just sit on our cushions and look at each of us. Oh, I have a lot of Padma energy. Oh, I wish I had more of a, you know, cultivating this for myself. But putting our collective selfless energies together and doing, reaching out to the wider community. So the shadow side of this is that, you know, Bernie has a lot of karma energy and a lot of Padma. He has a lot of these energies, but he's not really good at organizing. He can launch, he has lots of ideas, and he launched a lot of projects, but catastrophe in organizing. His Ratna qualities of financial management are poor, let's say, or were poor. And so everything he organized would often end up bankrupt. So, and he would just, you know, he perfected the art of begging by going and getting money from governments and grants and things like this. Companies, you know, really perfected begging. But then he didn't perfect so well the Ratna practice of making it become fructifier, in French, you know, sustaining it, yeah, the resources like that. So he basically, he created this company, Greystone, it's called, in New York, in Yonkers in New York. And basically they wanted to bring in some other people to manage it. But they said, okay, we will come in and manage it and take care of it, but the one condition is Bernie has to leave. Because with Bernie was involved, finances were terrible. And he selflessly agreed. Yeah, he left. He said, okay. I don't think it was so easy for him to do, but it was fine. And he moved on to some other project then. But that was what made it happen, was because he stepped out selflessly when he saw that his, you know, neurotic Ratna energy was not functioning properly. And he generously gave the company over to this other board of directors. And it still thrives today. At least the bakery does, you know, and they still make lots of cakes and cookies and things, which they sell all over the place. And it's a terrific thing. You know, I always give gifts at Christmas time. I order their cakes because the money goes to all these projects they have. And they're really good cakes, and you know, there's vegan ones, and there's, you know, they're organic, and they make the cookies and the brownies that go in Ben and Jerry's ice cream. So they made, early on, they made a deal with Ben and Jerry's. I don't know, do you have Ben and Jerry's ice cream here? Mm-hmm. Which is also, you know, a company that is involved with social action, climate, you know, taking care of their resources and things like that. And so the brownies that go into whatever their brownie, I don't eat that ice cream, but you know, they have like Brownie Delight or something. Those brownies are made by Greystone, which was founded by Bernie. So this is just an example of what can happen in an enlightened society, an enlightened community that reaches out, that develops these qualities, looks at these qualities and develops them. Are we out of time?
3 minutes. We have 10 minutes.
Okay. So just, this is an example of what can happen. And like I said, ZCLA, the Zen Center of Los Angeles, is built around these energies too, and that's how they govern their community even, is from these different aspects of the mandala. So you know, we can look at each one of them more in depth or in different ways throughout the week if you want to. Today, right now, if you have any questions or comments or... some of you have probably heard of this before. Patricia was like nodding. I think Patricia has done work around this. I don't know in what context, but...
I studied this back with the families for a master in the university.
Oh, yes, you told me that, yeah.
The blue family, well, in this case, it doesn't matter because it's the five working in the society. But traditionally, the practice begins with the blue.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because yes. You said as the last one.
No, because I just wrote these down randomly, but that's true.
Yeah. Sequence.
there's a sequence for it, and when you look at the mandala, then there's a sequence, and the Buddha's one is in the middle. So Miguel knows about this too, that's right, I forgot about that. And you know, there's different ways of working. So Bernie had us, we had a study group where we studied his text, which was that book that had just come out, Infinite Circle, which is around, I don't know if it's been translated in Portuguese, but so we, in the study group, we studied that text, and he assigned us each one of the families. So I was assigned the Vajra family. I wonder why. And Michel Dubois was assigned the Buddha family.
I wonder why, too.
That's pretty clear, yeah. So anyway, we each were assigned one of the families. And then we each had to take a persona that we identified with or that we really wanted to look into. I chose Walt Whitman, the American poet Walt Whitman, because I'm a poet and I love Walt Whitman and I identify with him. And Geno Roshi chose, I think, Teresa of Avila, you know, the Spanish Teresa. Frank, of course, chose Francis of Assisi. So, you know, people chose different things like this. So we had to read the text. And then when we talked about the text, we had to each talk about it from our own personal experience reaction to the text, like we do in our study group online. And we had to talk about it from the point of view of our Buddha family that we had been assigned. So what would be the Vajra view of this text of Bernie's? And from the point of view of our persona. So I had to look at this text of Bernie's, how Walt Whitman would look at it. This was really fascinating study group that we did. In any case, this helped us to really develop an affinity for the different families, for our own families. And I, you know, I said I have a strong Vajra component, but I discovered when this workshop we did with Debbie, that Debbie was at too, I discovered that, as we frequently do, I actually have a really strong Padma component, but I, from the Vajra view, that's terrifying, Padma, too emotional, you know, too warm. And so I masked that with my Vajra energy and stifled the Padma energy. We each do this in different ways. We even have like family, like my family is very, my personal biological family is very much like that too, very Vajra, but also big Padma. You know, we say nations can be, have, you know, like I said, the Japanese aesthetic and all of that is very Vajra. The American is kind of like all of them mixed together, neurotic, right? But, you know, we could look at it from different point of views. You know, Portugal for me is very Padma. So, you know, this, we can see how this applies in many different ways. Are we out of time now?
5 minutes. Can I ask something about that?
Yeah.
So in the story, I'm really interested in how he strongly went one way to compensate, you know, to compensate for this luxury New York vibe.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of, as you said, perfected begging and didn't, you know, it sort of feels like we're always working with counter forces in ourselves and the way you're speaking as well.
Yep.
There's something about the beauty of that second layer of seeing or the importance of it in the story that I'm just
exactly
struck by.
Exactly. Well, and that's exactly how it works to transmute them. In order to, you know, I'll give you the example of the Vajra energy at Naropa. They actually have rooms that are built. It's really crazy. They have these rooms that are built according to the standards of the energy, right? And the way the windows are made are even according to the energy. And then for each of the energy, there's a posture, a body posture. You remember this from the workshop?
Yeah.
Where for each day, for the Ratna, there's a posture you have to go into, and for Vajra, for all of them. So and when you work with the energy, so the Vajra posture is lying flat on your stomach, with your arms out like this and your head turned to one side. And you're supposed to, in Trungpa's scheme, do this for 45 minutes, take a break, and then for 45 minutes. What that posture for the Vajra is torture, because they can't see anything. Can't see anything. They and their Vajra energy is seeing clearly and precisely and seeing everything as it is. But lying there like this with your head to the side, you can't see anything. So it's like, and it really enhances the neurotic aspect. So that's where you go into the poverty of Ratna and see what that brings up, you know, this poverty mentality of not having enough, you know. So the way Bernie was using that was to bring these rich people into the poor community, see what it's like, see what that brings up for them, you know, and see how that can be transmuted into generosity, so something like that. But that, you know, it's a really good point.
Did Greystone stay as a Zen practice?
No.
It just became a charity.
Yeah, it's still a charity, but it's still affiliated with the Zen Peacemakers, but it's not it's not a Zen thing. Although, I don't know if it's still the guy who's the chairman, but the guy who took over, I think it's different now. But the guy who took over from Bernie and for many years was the chairman of the board of it was someone had been a student of Trungpa, and so was a Buddhist and had been involved with it. But it's not Buddhist now, no. But I think they still work with the same kinds of, their model is still set up in the same way.
I definitely think this would be an improvement. I have volunteered with 5 different associations in France. I had a long talk with Frank Rushi about this because just every single time the problem is nobody really knows what they're doing there as a group. Everybody wants to be a good person and everybody wants to be the boss. We have a little problem there. And they don't cohere and the project kind of flops. And we're talking about Emmaüs and big time, you know, association. Probably because they don't have a basic plan of what exactly are we doing together, rather than, okay, well, let's just, here are our actions, but it doesn't ever, in my experience, it doesn't cohere because they don't really have this sort of understanding of what's going on. Yeah, I think that would be a lot more enriching than the other way is, oh, we'll just be good people in here, blah, and it doesn't work out.
Well, and this is an example of the neurosis exists everywhere in every organization, everywhere. And so we think that, you know, something that is volunteer, that is supposed to be a charity or something, should have enlightened energy, you know, and the people doing it should. But actually they shouldn't. I mean, you know, it's like you say, if it's not cultivated, then, yeah, it might, but it might not, you know. We're almost out of time, so, yeah.
The ones who are overseas, the old scene, the one that is in charge, as a specific color, or in principle would be the white, but maybe it's depending on the kind of society, the kind of...
Yeah, that's a good question, too, that we brought up in our General Assembly when I talked about it. At the Zen Center of Los Angeles, the white, when they first created it, I don't know what it is now, was the abbot. She represented the white circle, as it were. I think now they've expanded it, so in the white circle is... Well, I'll talk about this more tomorrow, but it's different people who are in charge of different aspects who are in the white circle as well, something like that. I'll get more into that another day, because I think we're out of time now, right?